Hello and welcome to another episode of the Triple Exposure Podcast. We did not die. We are still here. I'm your host, Scott Bourne, along with my co-host, Rich Harrington. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how's it going, Scott?
It's a wonderful thing that we didn't promise to do this on any particular schedule, isn't it?
Yeah, I was on the road for a couple of weeks getting in the family vacation with the kids, and Disneyland won over talking into a microphone.
Yeah, you spent like $1 billion at Disneyland, didn't you?
It wasn't that bad, actually. I actually, small photographic story there. I found a great place to stay for photographers, which is the Animal Kingdom Resort. My wife actually found it, and we stayed there for a couple days. And right outside your balcony, there's, you know, zebras and giraffes, and they just have, you know, windows that go right onto sort of their little savanna there. And great time lapse. I shot some nice HDR. I got some great animal shots. I mean, it's not like going on safari for real, but there was plenty of interesting things out my window to shoot that weren't plastic Disney characters.
Very cool. Well, I'm glad you had a good time. Today, we're going to do a show called Finding the Shot. And today's show is all about strategies for identifying what would make a good HDR, a good panoramic, and a good time lapse. Because a lot of the questions we have received come from people brand new at this, Rich, and they're not sure, you know, which settings work for which kinds of applications. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I think what I want to do is sort of work through this list from the starting with time lapse. We haven't covered as much time lapse on the 3Exposure, that's number 3exposure.com site. We still have to do a primer, by the way, there, which we are going to get done. We do have a panoramic and an HDR primer. Or do we have the time lapse primer up there?
Not yet. I've got the startings of it. We've got okay. A couple of articles up there on right. How many exposures do you need. I just need to lock.
We
got to
finish that up. But let's talk about what makes a good strategy for identifying a good time lapse opportunity. Rich, you go first.
Sure. One of the things that, you know, is sort of inherent in just the name itself is time lapse. You need to see the passing of time, and so because of that, I like to look for opportunities that will show activity. It really depends. You know, for example, when I was on vacation, I shot a lot of rapid fire time lapse where I was doing 1 second intervals of crowds and getting a lot of activity and passage, and that was cool. On the other hand, when I'm shooting, you know, landscapes or, you know, sunrises and sunsets, I'm looking for things that show the passage of time. So I love a good cloudy day with a gentle wind, or sunrise and sunset. Or if it is going to be the middle of the day, looking for long shadows that we could see drift across a scene. You really have to think about what's going to move in the shot. And of course, remember that in many cases, you're locking the shot down. Now, you know, we'll get onto topics like using motorized sliders and things like that. But I think for a lot of time lapse, you really have to think about, you know, how am I going to illustrate the passing of time?
Yeah, the way I like to describe it is you want to find a static shot that entertains movement. So you want to find a nice static location that would, let's say, make a wonderful landscape shot all by itself. Right? I was lucky enough to be in Alaska in March. I was in a place where I had a wonderful shot of the mountains on it the day that the full moon was rising, when we had sunset. So that was perfect. You know, the moon was coming up, the sun was going down, and I set it up, Rich, so that it would just be a great single shot panoramic or static photograph as a landscape. Once I knew I had that, then I knew, okay, well, where's the movement going to come from? All the things you just mentioned, water rippling, I had water in the foreground, I had the moon coming up behind the mountains, I had the clouds moving, I had the sun going down. So I had all this movement against a static background. And that was, to me, an immediate indicator that this will make a wonderful time lapse.
Yeah, I love to see action in the scene. You know, there are several different like iOS apps and Android apps that are sunpath calculators.
Yep.
And, you know, one of the ones that, you know, I like to use a lot of times is, I'm going to blank on the name. I will look it up here in just a second. But I like the ability to actually sort of see where it's going. Sunseeker, that's what it's called. And so when I turn it on, it actually gives me the ability to see through the camera on my phone and then actually see the path line looking at my horizon of where is the sun going to be. And so when I'm framing up my shots, I've never been blessed with a great internal compass of, you know, where is the sun going to rise or set or where is it going next? I wish I should. You know, I'm actually an Eagle Scout. I probably should have learned that at some point, but I rely on technology. And that lets me see, well, where is the sun going to be? So when I'm framing up my shot, oftentimes I'm trying to think about where is this shot going to begin and where it's going to end. I think a lot of times people are drawn to like sort of putting everything dead center, or they're framing it from the point of view of a great single exposure. Right. But you really need to start thinking about, well, where are things going to be moving within this scene, or, you know, what's going to be happening? One of my favorite time-lapse shots that I ever did was a great off of like Queen Anne Hill in Seattle, of seeing it going from sunset to evening and the traffic picked up and all the reflections in the buildings. You know, I had gone there the night before and had seen what it looked like and just watched it and didn't put the pressure on me of getting the shot. I just stopped by there for about 20 minutes right at, you know, just before sunset. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this is going on, this is going on. And I let that percolate with some ideas. My other safety technique at this point is a lot of times when I'm out shooting, I'll bring two or three cameras and put them on different settings, different intervals, different lens lengths, just because if I'm going to be standing there for a while anyways, you know, you learn by doing. And so, you know, that way I sort of don't, I don't have all my eggs in one basket. I could try a few things out.
Yeah, I really like to use a program called Helios.
Yep.
Have you seen that one?
That's a great one.
That gives you all the azimuth of the sunrise, sunset, moonrise. There's another one called Darkness, which is a little easier to figure out if you just want the times. Both of these iPhone apps get used regularly by me to help figure this stuff out. But at the end of the day, you've got to pick a location that looks like it's going to offer all the things you just described. Anytime, for instance, that I can find water and mountains juxtaposed against each other, I start thinking time lapse, because maybe birds are going to come in and out as a flock. Maybe boats are going to come by. You see what I'm talking about? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I got a great shot. That same shot on Seattle when I was there, there was the Seattle ferries going back and forth. And those made great shots. Even after it got really dark, just shooting the ferries at night were pretty. And, you know, sometimes you have to think about near versus far. In that same location as I was experimenting, I got some great time-lapse shots of things far away and the beautiful landscape. And then all of a sudden, I just noticed as it got later and later in the evening, more and more people were coming late at night, and there are these great shots of the cars pulling up and in and out and people stopping and getting out and tourists and taking pictures. And I switched to a really long exposure, like a 2-second exposure of just these great light streaks of cars pulling up and stopping and going and people getting in and out as they were, you know, going to this great scenic overlook. So sometimes with time-lapse, it could, you know, great time-lapse can be everything from the extreme close-up on the flower as it grows over the course of weeks to the most beautiful gigantic vista that you could see, and everything in between. And so, you know, it's just so interesting, the concept of passage of time. Another thing that I'll sometimes just do is, you know, I'll look at video clips of particular locations and just set them to extreme fast forward. You don't get the same quality as you would with the time lapse, but as you're sort of experimenting or looking for motion, that's a good idea to just sort of see what's happening in this location. You know, I love a good partly cloudy day.
Well, I'll wrap this part of the show up talking about something from Seattle. I used to live there for 15 years, so I have some ideas on this regarding Seattle. There's
a lot of partly cloudy days in Seattle.
Yeah. In fact, we like to think of those as partly sunny because we're optimistic. The Capitol Hill area is a great place to go to shoot shots of downtown Seattle and the water. And I did a time lapse years ago. I'll try to find it and put it up on the site. It's one of the first I ever did. I actually did something I don't even know what made me think to do it, and I've never done it since, but I'm going to start doing it now that I remember this. I did two different focal lengths and two different time lapses, one above the other. I used a long lens to shoot the moon coming up behind the Space Needle, and I used a shorter lens to shoot the overall scene, and then I ran them in Final Cut Pro one on top of the other.
Oh, nice.
And that ended up looking super cool. So you can set up more than one camera to run time lapse if you have access to more than one camera, and you can change focal lengths and get a completely different perspective. You can either superimpose those, blend them together, cut one to the other, run them top to bottom. There's a lot of different stuff. Let's move on to talking about finding a good panoramic opportunity, Rich. I like to look for something that has a large scenic vista as a great place to start with panoramic, where maybe there's more going on the wide side than there is the high side, and too much to be able to get in a conventional lens. That's sort of my starting point, where I want to document scale and size. How about you?
Yeah, I definitely favor, you know, panoramic photos for those great locations. You know, I'm always thinking whenever I get to a location and I hop out of the car and I start to look around, you know, oh, before I start getting into details here, let's shoot panoramic. You know, right in your backyard, I know you've got great places there. I've shot so many panoramics over at Red Rock just because, you know, if you get there at the right time of day, there's so many interesting things to see. I think that, you know, one of the things I've always been drawn to just because of my early days with VR is 360 panoramics. And so a lot of times I'll want to capture several locations in one spot to create a virtual tour, so a person really has a feeling of going there. And I think that if you're going to interesting places or historic places, you know, like in my backyard, Washington, D.C., you know, a 360 panoramic could be very interesting and really help somebody do virtual tourism. On the other hand, for panoramics that I'd want to print, I'm right there with you. You know, I want that view that just reminds me of what it felt like when I stood there at the start of the shoot or at the beginning of the shoot and just looked and surveyed the scene, that really breathtaking view that brings you back to that great location.
Yeah, I haven't actually done any 360 panoramics, but I do enjoy looking at them. But I haven't actually ever done any. So for me, it's always been a matter of trying to find something where I want to compress a lot of information into one image and more information than I can with just a single exposure. By the way, I like to look for vertical panoramas. I know most everybody looks strictly for horizontal, and I start there myself, but I don't want to, I mean, I mentioned horizontal panoramics, but I don't want to ignore the vertical panoramics. They're much harder to find.
Yeah.
But if you do something like with a road, and you have an, I went to Monument Valley. Most people have seen Monument Valley in a various BMW or Mercedes ads. It's where they seem to photograph all the good car ads. And I went in that road that leads right down to the Mittens. I stood up and did a panoramic vertical there that's still one of my favorite panos I ever shot.
And on that front, you know, were you hand-holding that, or were you using special gear?
No, what I actually did was, fortunately, that road is not very much trafficked on Sunday mornings. So I went and just stopped my car right in the middle of the road, and I had my tripod. Actually, it was in my truck, and I had my tripod in the back, and I just stood up there and made the shot.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think a lot of people, there's sort of two camps with panorama. You know, there are the purists who are getting into nodal point and all that extra gear. And I don't want, that's a topic for another day. But I think a lot of people are afraid to embrace panorama. I've been doing great panoramics just handheld for a long time. I mean, I will use the right gear when I have it. You know, if it's sitting there, plug in and use it. But it's amazing how good the software has gotten. And I love the vertical panoramas. I also sometimes will do collage style panoramas where I don't worry about them getting perfectly lined up.
Yeah.
You know, I think the other thing with panoramics that are nice is sometimes, and we just had a post on this on the site where we did a tutorial about capturing really busy scenes. Sometimes I like a panorama just to capture the energy of a location,
sure,
especially when there's just hundreds of people. It you know, looking at a photo like that for me just brings me back a sense of, you know, wow, photojournalism, capturing the life or the activity in a particular scene. And so, you know, urban panoramic photography, I would rather see the busy city. You know, I'm not a big fan of getting those, you know, shot in, you know, when there's nobody around, you know, Times Square type pictures or, you know, shooting long exposures and removing people from the scene. I think if you're in a beautiful environment, you know, and there's not a lot of people, go for that empty frame or make an empty frame. But if you're going to be doing one where it's a busy urban environment, look for activity, look for good energy.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a world full of people. I think it's weird when the people aren't there. That's my own opinion. But, well, I'm heading to Pennsylvania next weekend, and one of the stops I'm going to make is in a little town called Carlisle, Pennsylvania, for an event called Corvettes at Carlisle. It's the largest gathering of Corvettes in the world. There'll be more than 5,000 Corvettes there, Rich, and you can bet I got me some serious panoramic ideas.
Oh, so, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, we'll see what we'll see if I can get 5,000 Corvettes in a single photograph. I may need a helicopter for that one. But all right, let's finish up here by discussing strategies for identifying good HDR moments. Finding the shot is the theme of today's show on 3 Exposure. And by the way, if you like what we're doing here, we do the podcast irregularly. We're trying to do it at least once a month. We'll try to speed it up as time goes by. But we post Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3, that's the number 3, exposure.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at 3Exposure if you like this stuff where we cover just HDR, panoramic, and time lapse. As far as HDR goes, Rich, I happen to think that most people probably get this. HDR works best in situations where you are trying to cover a large dynamic range, hence the name high dynamic range. But for me, I like to start with shots that include something that I almost never include in a photograph, which is the sun.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I sort of think as HDR is a perfect time when I'm seeing beautiful things with my eyes. You know, like the HDR technology just lets you get so much in there. And so opportunities where, you know, sunrise, sunset, that would often get lost in a photo. But you're right. It's a great opportunity there to, you know, actually get the beams of the sun in there or to really see really dramatic shadows. I think that's a great opportunity there. Harsh lighting often works well in HDR.
Yeah, I think it works best, actually. I've seen some HDRs, my own included, where really there was no need for the HDR. There wasn't that much dynamic range in the scene, and all it ended up doing was making everything dirty and noisy.
For some folks, you know, HDR is sort of an excuse to like go, oh, it's back to the early days of Photoshop with a ton of filters.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a really a dynamic situation where you're shooting, then HDR is great. I mean, we're not going to get into the arguments we've talked on other shows and on the site of, you know, HDR not to HDR, but I think you're right. You know, if you remember that HDR is ultimately a tool for showing a wider range than the camera can capture, you know, more in line with the type of range you see with your own eyes, then those situations where you have dramatic lighting really plays in, you know. So I'm right there with you. I like to find a scene that has good shadows and highlights in it, you know, where there's not just bright sunset or, you know, bright sunrise or bright lighting, but rather it's mixing the two. So instead of being out in the open shooting in the light, step into the shadows of an archway or, you know, the peaking of a tunnel or shooting through a doorway. Looking for those opportunities when you're mixing lighting conditions, I think often works really well. Or an interior where you're looking out the window.
Right.
Those mixed lighting situations or dramatic lighting is really kind of cool.
Well, all the things that back in the film days and pre-Photoshop where we used to say either or. So do you want me to hold detail in the sky or do you want me to hold detail in the interior? Because it was never possible to do both back then. Now we can do both, and I think anytime you have extreme lighting, I mean, our eyes are capable, Rich, of about twice the dynamic range of the best cameras. So we need to look at situations, and one of the best ways to know you need an HDR is to just take a quick snapshot, look at your LCD and say, whoa, that's all blown out. Or, wow, all those shadows are blocked up. Well, what that should be is a little ding, 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 ding. It's HDR time. That's when you know to do it. And if you have a lot of specularity in the scene, Rich, that's another time to really contemplate using HDR. Specularity, and another thing I like to look for is textures. One thing that HDR tends to give us the ability to do better than a single shot is to develop texture in a photograph, which is important because we live in a 3D world. We're reduced to 2D when we're making pictures. The notion of texture tends to pull us back towards that third dimension.
Well, I'm a history junkie. I was a history minor in school, and you know, whenever I'm traveling, I love to go to historical sites. And so, you know, I've shot some great black and white HDRs, interiors in churches and old historic sites, you know, being here in DC, going to some of the monuments at night. I really think, you know, nighttime shooting or low light shooting is another opportunity for HDR to really come through. While you could do that single long exposure to get the lighting levels that you need to get, you know, proper contrast, you really lose those rich details and the stone textures and the grass and, you know, the walls. And you're right, it's really nice to preserve some of that. So, you know, that's when you start getting into, you know, for me, low light shooting, 5 exposures or 7 exposures to really capture that. I don't know. I'm sure you can go more than that, but I usually top out around 5 exposures tops if I'm doing a low light HDR.
Yeah, I think 5 is usually good. A lot of times 3 will work, but where I tend to want 7 is if I've got the sun in the picture, just the opposite of what you just described. If I've got the sun directly in the photograph, then I tend to try to make 7 exposures just to be safe.
It just sort of
solves any particular problems we might have.
And I think one of the things that on all three of these things we've been talking about that bears repeating is, especially for the HDR and the pano, shooting raw and even time lapse, I'm juggling, I would say at this point I'm doing about half my time lapses with raw. It really is a great saver for dealing with tough exposure situations. Of course, you know, with time lapse, then you add the need for huge, very, very fast cards. So it depends on the type of shooting I'm doing. But if I'm doing shorter, more intense shots and I've got the time budgeted for the processing, I'll still go raw there. But, you know, I think if you're putting all this effort into finding the shots, if you're not capturing raw, you're giving up a ton of data.
Yeah, it once again, if I'm going to do something really extreme, like where I'm going to shoot 7 shots, I probably will shoot raw. I do occasionally shoot JPEG just because I think it's going to be easier to get the image I want out of, you know, 3 or 4 or 5, 7 shots. I'm going to cover everything well enough. But I do go with raw probably 70-80% of the time now, because I've just decided it's not that big a deal to convert the – I mean, if you're shooting 7 raw shots, you make the correction to 1, you batch apply it to the remaining 6. It doesn't take that much time, Rich.
No. I mean, I think the tools have really caught up. And, you know, it's just giving you that extra flexibility. The other thing that's nice, too, is, you know, some of the things in Photoshop with the lens correction features are working really nice, you know, to compensate for any sort of lens distortion or unwanted vignetting that sometimes can plague those shots. But, yeah, it's definitely – things are moving in the right way there. I mean,
we're even seeing it in cameras. I just got the brand new Olympus EP3.
Uh-huh.
And it'll do some of this stuff right in camera.
You could do HDR in camera?
Well, you can kind of do HDR camera. You can do panoramic for sure in camera.
Yeah, that's really cool.
You just take the pictures and it does the work. It also does tilt shift and everything else. But there's really no reason why, since we're doing this in software and post, there's no reason why that can't be dropped onto an EEPROM inside a camera and do it in the camera.
Yeah. And actually on that front, I found myself having fun with Panorama more and more. We talked about panoramic apps. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the Photosynth app from Microsoft.
Oh, I've played with it, yeah.
I got some real fun ones while on vacation, just, you know, finding myself standing in lines. I shot a great one inside of the Space Mountain waiting line with all the neon, and I got another one and a couple other tourist places. And I was like, you know, these are some pretty good pictures. You know, what I found was what I found interesting, you know, these were not pictures that I had any intention in selling. So I went ahead and pushed them up to the net and let them go, you know, get attached in geotag so people looking at maps could start to see some of what's there. You know, these are fun, but, you know, it's amazing what's becoming possible. And sometimes I'll even use that as a tool when I'm scouting locations to just bang out a really quick panorama right inside the camera. You know, I'm not in a position to do like some photographers are, where they always have a camera on their shoulder. I think that's the tax of having small children. You know, I sometimes have to decide I'm going to go shooting and take all the gear with me to get the results that I want. I can go out with a single camera and, you know, have my tourist lens on me. But when I really want to shoot those great panos, I'll often go out with multiple bodies, you know, one's doing time lapse, another's doing pano. I'm maximizing my location. So I think it just depends on your style of shooting, but using your tool on the phone as sort of a framing or a pre-visualization device can be helpful.
I agree. Well, I think we've covered all the things we can in this particular episode of the Triple Exposure Podcast. Remember, we're at the number 3exposure.com. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with brand new posts on time-lapse, HDR, and panoramic photography. Rich, when you're not hanging out with me doing this show and working on that site, where can people find you?
They can follow me on social media through RedPixel, R-H-E-D-P-I-X-E-L. That's also the name of my production company. And I have a personal blog at richardharringtonblog.com.
Cool. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Bourne. And if you're interested in other stuff related to photography, try photofocus.com, where we publish 7 days a week general photography tips. That is all the time we have for this episode of the Triple Exposure Podcast. We thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.